This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We're all trying to put our political views and enshrine them in things like street names and even highway names and statues. It's just kind of what we do as a modern people.
What does naming and renaming streets, buildings, airports, and even bodies of water say about us as a people? Whether a name inspires, entertains, or haunts us, there's power in assigning words to people, places, and things. We can see it unfolding right before our eyes with the current U.S. administration renaming key landmarks. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Deirdre Mask, the author of The Address Book, What Street Addresses Reveal About Identity, Race, Wealth, and Power. We learn about the history of attributing names and numbers to roads and houses, look at how important seemingly obvious innovations like zip codes are, and discuss the socio-political impact of things named after Confederate leaders. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Deirdre Mask. She is a nonfiction writer, from the U.S. originally, based in London now. And her brilliant first book is entitled The Address Book, What Street Addresses Reveal About Identity, Race, Wealth, and Power. Deirdre, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
So when you started first telling people that you were writing a book about addresses, what kind of reaction were you getting, and how did you decide to focus on this? At a glance, it seems like a fairly arcane, narrow topic, but as readers can attest, it's a very wide palette that you work with here.
It's so weird. Not even just how do they first react, how do they continue to react? That when I talk about, you know, I was working on a street about street addresses at a dinner party, you know, people would sort of back away or turn to the other side because it sounds like this extremely boring topic. I didn't start out writing a book about this. I actually started out by writing an article. I wrote an article for The Atlantic magazine about the state of West Virginia, which was at the time giving street names and addresses and house numbers to the rural residents of West Virginia. So I wrote sort of an article, but I got such an interesting response to that from so many people talking about addresses and addresslessness that I started looking into it more. And then I wrote another article for the Guardian newspaper about streets named after Martin Luther King and the reputation that streets named after Martin Luther King have. And I was tracking a man who in St. Louis who was who has a mission to sort of rehabilitate the image of Martin Luther King Jr. streets and actually rehabilitate the streets themselves, which often are in decline, though not always.
As Chris Rock notes, right?
Chris Rock notes, yes, yes.
Yeah, what's the joke?
The joke goes along something like, if you find yourself on Martin Luther King Jr. Street, run, right? Right. And there's a reason that the joke was funny, at least in a certain way. You can see the point he was making, which was that the image of Martin Luther King Jr. streets and the actuality of many of them, though, as I said, not all of them, which is part of the story as well, is of streets often in decline. And they were often in Black neighborhoods, which because of, I'll just put the wide swath of American history, were not always, the nicest streets in town. And so this became part of the reputation. And then in some places, like St. Louis, it became true.
And when you wrote this Atlantic article, and by the way, this kind of reminds me of a hidden gem of a book that I really liked. I don't know if it sold a lot, but it was called The Island of Lost Maps, A True Story of Cartographic Crime by Miles Harvey. He wrote, I think, a piece in Outdoor Magazine or something on rare maps. And then it goes into the whole history of maps and how valuable they were, more valuable than the spices themselves were the spice routes, for example. When you were looking at the issue with street addresses in rural West Virginia, did you realize that you were going into a topic that was going to tell us so much about society as a whole, health, history, cities, inequality, etc.
Zero. I had zero of those expectations when I went to sort of rural West Virginia. I thought I was writing this story that was going to be kind of quirky, like, oh, isn't this interesting kind of exploration? And how do you give lots of streets names? And in some sense, it turned out to be true. It was, you know, there were many funny stories about how streets became, you know, called Cougar Lane because of a certain older lady who lived on the street or, you know, I mean, there was in some ways, there were lots of those kinds of stories. But actually, the more I saw it, the more it was very obvious that the county I was in, McDowell County, was at the time, I believe, was the second poorest sort of district in America. And is it any surprise that these were people who hadn't been counted or named and overlooked? You know, I really started to see that power and addresses and wealth kind of came together. And then something else really interesting happened, which is that addressing in West Virginia wasn't popular. There was a sizable minority who said, like, we don't want these addresses. We don't want street names and house numbers. And I would ask people about this. I'd be like, why is this? You know, why don't people want addresses? And people would say, oh, you know, these people are ignorant. They're uneducated. They don't really know what addresses are. But actually, the more I researched it, the more I realized that these people were kind of right in a way, and that they understood that this wasn't just about addressing for things like 911, which was the main reason. Of course, you want an ambulance to get to your door. But it was also very useful for the state to know exactly where you are. And that's sort of the history of the modern state. They just need to know where you are. It's why your address is what you have to give on your bank account, even though no bank manager is ever going to come to your door. And again, it's to find people. So those people in West Virginia, they knew this, that the state could now find them, police them, tax them, do all of these things the state does more easily. And it really depends on your view of the state. I tend to have a pretty pro-state view in general. So, you know, I don't feel particularly threatened by these things. But people have different ideas about the state, for better or for worse. And addressing ties really neatly into this because, you know, the history of the growing modern state really is a history of the state being able to find us.
Yes, the idea of addressing, if we can use that as a verb, is a fairly mutualistic relationship between the state and the citizenry. On the surface, it looks like you mentioned, oh, well, that's something you want to have because you want to get your post and for emergency reasons and just navigating around a city. It's pretty nice to have street names to look at and numbers. But it dates back to the Habsburg Empire in Vienna in the 1740s. Was it Maria Therese? Was she the empress at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah, why don't you explain the actual reason was like the draft and tax collection, right?
Absolutely. So there's a time where you can kind of picture the world as being generally unaddressed. I mean, that's sort of a large generalization, but yes, but this idea of house numbers. So there's a chapter just on house numbers, which sounds like it should be the most boring chapter, but I actually think it's the most interesting chapter in the whole book. So you have this time when there's just no house numbers and no way to find people. But again, at the time, like I said, that's the states, you know, talking about Europe largely at this point in the book, they didn't really care that much about the people in them. So for example, the sort of idea was that you sort of have this powerful leader and they care that their borders are protected and they care that the people give them money for taxes and that they don't, like, you know, try to overthrow them. But they don't really care whether their subjects are educated or whether they really do anything. You know, they don't, or whether they're healthy. For the large, but that's not really a concern of the state in the same way. But this begins to change in lots of ways, that the state begins to need to rely on their citizens and also to promote healthy citizens. So in the case of Maria Theresa of the Habsburg Empire, this is, you know, largely sort of Austria, Germany, Hungary, you know, a huge empire. She is just fighting all of these wars, just constantly fighting wars. She also had something like 16 children. I may be getting that wrong, but I think including one was Marie Antoinette.
She needed street addresses just to find her kids.
Exactly. She just needed street address. And funny enough, her palace, of course, she numbers one when she does these house numbering. Yeah. But she realizes she has all these wars. She needs to draft people. And other places this was done to house soldiers or for tax purposes. But she needs soldiers. But she realizes she doesn't really know who even lives in her empire, right? Because how would you know? You don't have address. You have no way of tracking people, really. So so the military sort of fans out all across her empire to sort of number. They even have this description of what the ink was. It was like charred bones and oil or something like that. And they paint these numbers on and people lose it, right? In the same way the people I was talking about West Virginia didn't want them because they know what's happening, right? They were sort of anonymous to the state. And once they put a house number on there and they connect it with their name, they're suddenly not anonymous to the state anymore. And they can be drafted and later taxed. Now, this also comes with lots of good things. A lot of this house numbering combines across Europe with the state getting better at trying to, you know, have a healthy citizenry, at trying to educate people. You know, these developments in the modern state that we also see as good also sort of correspond with these changes. But yeah, so it really is essential for a state to become modern. I put modern in quotes, but in the sense of being able to run administratively and function well administratively is really tied up with the identification of citizens.
Has got two windows and the sunshine never comes through. You know it's felt so dark and lonely since I broke it off, girl, with you. I live on a laundry avenue. Little girl, don't say I do. You know it's felt so sad and blue, and it's all because of you. I could cry.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Deidre Mask. She is the author of The Address Book. So we can't curse on this show, but there are a lot of very odd names in England that are kept over. You have an interesting section where you're talking about the preservation of all these areas of ill repute and how they're reflected in the street names, and people are clinging to them largely.
Yes. I won't use the actual names, but I'll just leave it to your imagination. But there were, you know, this goes back to a point that we were talking about before about maps. You know, like mapping was really incredibly valuable. And a lot of people didn't have maps even of a town, right? So you're a sailor and you come into town. One of the ways that you might navigate the town is through street names, even if you don't really have a map. So for example, if somebody tells you this road is Cloth Fair, which is a street name in London, you know, that's where you get clothes, or this is, you know, Frying Pan Alley. Well, okay, this is where you get things like, you know, pots and pans. And so there were also street names that were named after sort of ill repute that would also tell you, yes, here's where you might find a prostitute, right? Or here's a good place to, you know, to meet a woman. I will put in or man, probably. I'll put all of that in quotes for you. But street names became reflective of how we saw the city, and you still see this very clearly in London. I think anybody who's been to London can see that, because so many of the streets, the old street names, are named after how the street was used. You know, Milk Street or. They're just very standard. Even the ones that aren't as interesting, there's like the most popular streets are Church Street, you know, Station Road, Market Street. Even now, these street names often correspond to what's on them.
We've spoken about MLK streets and some of these red light districts. But on the flip side, we see other markers of social standing. I'm just thinking of if a town adds by the sea to it as a suffix, all of a sudden that area is a little more desirable, and it's often reflected in real estate prices, let's say.
Totally. I mean, you know, capitalism and street names go together, of course. I mean, this is why, you know, where I grew up in North Carolina, I mean, it's just a new subdivision pops up all the time. And you just look at the street names, you know, they're just all, you know, these beautiful, you know, beautiful names of flowers or, you know, old-timey farms that used to be there. You know, they're very highly marketable. Like, it really feels like it was a marketing team that sat down and did them rather than, say, a historian. Because, of course, street names go up. And this comes up the most in the book about New York, which, you know, as far as when I wrote the book in 2020, I haven't heard that it's been repealed. But there's a system in New York in which you could pay money to get a street name that wasn't actually your street name. So you could have a building that was on Park Avenue that was actually not on Park Avenue at all, but maybe, on a neighboring block.
And you could see the public safety issue that this causes, because emergency vehicles don't know where they're going. It's like if you're saying 500 Park Avenue and you end up on the buildings half a block down on 23rd Street, that's going to be a little confusing.
It doesn't make any sense. And the weird thing that's really weird to me is that these buildings are extremely expensive buildings. So these are the very upper crust of Manhattan real estate. And so I always find it funny that even though you're in some of the fanciest buildings in Manhattan, you still want other people to know that you're really fancy, right? Like, it's all about image, you know, because of course, if you own an apartment here, you're extremely fancy. You wouldn't in theory need people to think you lived on Park Avenue. They already know you're a zillionaire, right? Just because you live in this building. But people and developers still need it. And apparently it still works. You know, it still works. Those addresses still have a lot of cachet.
Well, let's turn to zip codes for a second, if we can. They're highly predictive of life expectancy and other social determinants of health outcomes. You talk about England's cholera epidemic. That was pre-zip code. I was fascinated to learn that the zip codes are a relatively new invention. This guy, Mr. Zip, Robert Moon, came up with it.
What is it? Again, this is dating me for the book, but you know, this is the 60s. Am I getting that right?
Well, I read it more recently than you've written it. He came up with it in the mid 40s, and then he lobbied for it for like 20 years, and then in the early 60s, they finally were like, "All right, we'll go with this idea." And they say that it saves like $9 billion a year.
They're incredibly useful. I mean, and it's interesting that what you said, that tracks social determinants, because it wasn't designed for that. I mean, it was really designed to help the mail function more efficiently by giving these smaller areas to deliver the mail. And it's very effective that way. Ireland, for example, only recently got zip codes not that long ago. It's a few years ago, really. And of course, everybody was like, we don't need these. We're Ireland. We know everybody. And now they love them and they use them all the time, right? Because these are incredibly efficient things. But what's happened, interestingly, is that they've now become ways of describing where you live. You know, we all know 90210, right? Like they weren't really designed for that, but they've also become useful markers to show different social determinants of things like health and crime, that you can compare different zip codes. COVID was a good example. You'd often see maps of COVID levels done by zip code. Marketers are big fans of zip codes because you can target a zip code and know that these are, you know, affluent retired communities or these, you know, young students. And, you know, you can actually use the zip codes in ways of marketing as well. But again, that wasn't the intent at all. It was really for the efficiency of the Postal Service.
And I'm also thinking political canvassers. If you're looking at trying to reach blue or red neighborhoods, you can focus on a zip code.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we've talked about zip codes and the birth of modern addresses, but you mentioned how in West Virginia, people were a little reticent to have the state get into their business, so to speak, and then they weren't really eager to have an address.
Yes, I mean, a lot of people were, but there was a sizable community that didn't. Yeah,
sure. You mentioned in the book that the unhoused, the number one thing that they're pining for in a survey was a street address. So how can street addresses help tackle the issue of homelessness more effectively?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this book, for example, sort of starts in starts in New Haven, where there was this law student. It is a city of great divides, right? Because you have Yale and you have a sort of post-industrial city, the rest of it. Anyway, so you have this law student and she's really interested in learning something about homelessness and writing something, but she decided she doesn't really know anybody who doesn't have a home. So she goes out onto the green and she talks to lots of unhoused people and she's sort of asking them what they need. And I guess like a lot of the needs are very obvious, like, of course, you want a home. But a number of people told her, what I really need is an address. You know, I just need an address. And this is sort of curious, because why do you need an address? Well, it ties into all the kinds of things we've been talking about. The modern state really requires you to have one in order to do ordinary things like vote or get a bank account or in many of these people's cases, get a job. Because on the application form for any job, there's an address. And if you don't have one, people assume that you are homeless and then they discriminate against you. And there are business people who admit to this, right? That they think that people who, you know, live in homeless shelters are unreliable, right? And so if they put their homeless shelter address, they recognize that. Or if they put no address, they aren't able to pass as being housed, let's just say. We know from all this homelessness research that our assumptions about homelessness are totally wrong, right? Like, you know, in terms of only a very small percentage of homeless people are severely have mental health issues. You know, a lot of people are just families have, you know, have, you know, are one check behind paying their rent, right? Like these stereotypes are ingrained in our brains, ingrained in everybody's brains. Like there have been researchers that have looked at MRIs where people are able to look at a picture of somebody who is, you know, purportedly unhoused with somebody, you know, and then they relate them to garbage, right? Like these are these natural reactions that have been ingrained in us. And so what people need is they need a way of passing. You need an address basically to pass. So this law student proposed something called ban the address, which is an idea that why do you need to ask for an address at the first round of a job application? In the same way that there has been like ban the box movements to ban asking about criminal records at the start, just to give people a bit of a leg in. But then there's also some really interesting things going on where people are trying to assign people addresses just that they can use. And then it's not really a real address, but they can get it forwarded to a place that they can safely pick up their mail. But it's sort of a cover address that allows them to do all sorts of things like, again, bank and vote and register with a doctor here in the UK and actually receive mail to someplace like a homeless shelter without actually revealing that they themselves are homeless.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Deidre Mask. She is the author of The Address Book, What Street Addresses Reveal About Identity, Race, Wealth, and Power. So getting back to the names for a moment of these streets, I think it's kind of a barometer of where a society or a country might be. I'm just thinking of what you write about the Nazis versus Confederates. It reminded me of a flight I was taking to Virginia around 15 years ago. And I remember having a conversation with somebody from the South, and we were totally getting along, but we were having this discussion about, I remember at one point I said, like, you know, the South lost, and at least like the Germans lost their war, and they've decided not to allow swastikas and stuff. But it's kind of odd that the South embraces a lot of these, you know, Confederate generals and other symbols of this slave-based society. And some woman from a couple rows ahead of me turned around in this very Southern drawl, a white woman, and she was like, excuse me, do you mind keeping your voices down? Your conversation is offending me. And I was tongue-tied. I was just like, okay, sorry. But like afterwards, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe she said that. And we're at this crossroads now in this country where I think we're going to see, you know, you hear about like the biggest evil is wokeism and DEI, and just being an open-minded human being is terrible. So we're going to see street naming and other types of symbolism and language used as a cudgel, I think.
Totally. And we've already seen it with like sort of Gulf of America.
Right, right.
One thing I try to do in the book is I try not to take like too many sides. Like it's definitely not polemic. I just try to explore the complexity. And I think the Confederate one was really interesting for me for that, because I'm African-American, which is kind of an important term for me because I actually am American living abroad. So the African-American kind of means something to me. So I can't really be neutral on Confederate names, right? Like I very much felt that the debates I was talking about Confederate names were wrong and that all these street names should be changed. But I think there's also interesting in looking at the complexity of all of these debates, right? People have clung to these memories and this past as their stability. And there's lots of interesting theories that you can read about how, you know, modernity is making us move so fast that we have to like create all these memories and keep them in things like street names because our worlds are just changing. I mean, there's all sorts of theories. But there is a lot of complexities. And obviously everybody does this all the time now, right? Like we changed the Gulf of Mexico to Gulf of America, one political side. But then there's lots of streets named after Barack Obama or Martin Luther King. Like we're all trying to put our political views and enshrine them in things like street names and even highway names and statues. It's just kind of what we do as a modern people. And many times in the Confederate street names argument, for example, again, I have no time for somebody saying there should be a Robert E. Lee Street, but I would have time for a street name change after somebody that I admire. So it's something that we're constantly tussling with we're constantly battling name changes as a way of sort of enshrining our political views.
And you have a discussion with an African-American gentleman in the South for the book who was not for changing the names from this. He identified this, was it in Alabama or Mississippi? And he identified these with, like, this is my heritage too.
I mean, you kind of make assumptions about things, and I guess we can't make it. I mean, we see this in the Trump's election, like the people we thought would have been naturally Democratic weren't in a lot of cases. So I think branding any of these things. I mean, for example, you would meet people, I remember talking to someone about Lee Street. And this person was white, but in theory, they hated Robert E. Lee. They weren't like that woman on the plane. They had no attachment to the Civil War. But they were born on Lee Street. They brought their babies home to Lee Street. They were married on Lee Street. It was just the name itself is actually sort of intimately connected to our memories. And actually, there's some explanations of why this happens in the book with our brain. Like, we just connect these. So some people just see the complexity of this as being as people just have these connections with the name that are not rational. And so, for example, I talk a lot in the book about a street name here that was called Black Boy Lane, where we once looked at a house to buy on this street.
And there were like dozens of them, you said, right?
Exactly. There are others, this famous one. But this one, interestingly, the name was changed after I wrote the book to honor sort of a local activist. And interestingly, I wrote an article for The Times here in the UK, which showed that people who lived on the street, and this is in Tottenham in North London, this is not a fancy neighborhood. I think on the street, 78% of people were from some sort of minority community. So these are not people we ordinarily would think of as liking a street called Black Boy Lane. But actually, people on the street really wanted to keep it dramatically. And the further you got away from the street, the more people wanted to change it. Because when it comes down to it, a lot of people just don't want to change their own street name. Some people say administratively, some people say it's memory, some people don't want the bother. But actually, we do have very strong ties to what our streets are called. So it's complex.
Cities are constantly changing. Here in San Francisco, there's this badge of honor if you went to high school in San Francisco, you're a native, because there's a lot of transplants in San Francisco. I think Los Angeles is similar, but I was thinking of Cesar Chavez Street, used to be called Army. And so, like, anybody who's over 70 years old is still, like, thinks of it as Army. And so it's kind of almost a badge of honor to, like, know that, you know, like, I'm an OG.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even in my hometown, I grew up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, there's a street called Airport Road, and it's now changed to MLK Boulevard. Is it Boulevard? I can't remember the exact ending, but it's named after Martin Luther King, which, you know, I support. But because I think especially I've been away so long, it's really, really hard for me not to call it Airport Road. And whenever I do it, people, even now, you know, they, again, it's very OG, but probably not necessarily the best way. But it's hard to let go of the names you grew up with. There is something something that neuroscientists talk about in our brains about memory and place being connected. And so this is one of the reasons why name changing becomes so fraught.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and I'm really glad you decided to expand the article into a book. And I highly recommend our listeners check it out. It's called The Address Book, What Street Addresses Reveal About Identity, Race, Wealth, and Power. Deirdre Mask, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Oh, thank you so much, Alex. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Trace Bundy, Van Morrison, and Chris Wilson. To read a transcript of this show, go to seachangeradio.com. Stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast on our site or visit our archives to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, Gavin Newsom, Stuart Brand, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.